Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may hit star one on your touch-tone phone to ask a question. I would also like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jenny Lyons. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you, Jay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jenny Lyons, and I'm with Public Affairs here at NOAA. Today, NOAA is announcing our final ocean noise strategy roadmap. Levels of ocean noise have grown dramatically in recent decades, and this document shows NOAA's commitment to tackling this very big topic in a strategic way. We have a fantastic team of experts here to talk to you about the roadmap today. First, I have the privilege of introducing Jason Gadamke to you all right now. Jason is our Ocean Acoustics Program Manager at NOAA Fisheries. He'll provide a brief summary of our news, and then we'll open for questions. We also have Leila Hatch, a marine ecologist with the National Ocean Service, as well as Jolie Harrison, a biologist and chief of NOAA Fisheries Permits and Conservation Division, available to answer questions during this time. Just a reminder, though, this call is for working media only. If you're not a member of the press, you are welcome to listen, but please do not ask questions. This time is really reserved for reporters. With that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Jason. Jason, please go ahead.
Sure, thank you. And I'm just going to start off by saying that both Leila and Jolie, as well as along with myself, have been the leads on this effort. And so I would invite them at any point, even in these opening remarks, to jump in if you guys feel like there's anything you want to add and so on. So I'll just begin by sort of setting the context, telling a little bit of a story here to sort of give you a feeling for where this document arose from. When you consider the underwater acoustic environment, you need to keep in mind that sound travels incredibly well underwater. There was an experiment done back in the early 90s called the Heard Island Feasibility Test, where some researchers went, put a speaker in the water in the Southern Ocean, and played some sounds, and what they demonstrated was that sound actually had the ability to travel literally halfway around the world. Sounds were received in a range of the world's oceans off Bermuda and so on, and it really, in my mind at least, it really illustrates the fact that sound is an incredible property underwater, or at least has the incredible ability to travel vast distances. Now, when you pair that with the idea that marine life has had millions upon millions of years to evolve in the natural underwater acoustic environment, they've utilized that the excellent sound propagating properties of water in their daily life functions. So they use sounds for things like navigation, for finding prey, for avoiding predators. So obviously very key, important aspects of their lives of surviving underwater. Now, these animals have had millions of years to evolve in the natural acoustic environment. In the last, say, 100 to 150 or so years, really since the advent of the industrial age, consider then that human activities have been increasingly taking place in the oceans, and with things like propeller-driven ships, construction, industrialization, and so on, humans have added more and more sound into the world's oceans. So in just a tiny fraction of time on an evolutionary scale, we've really altered the underwater acoustic environment. We've altered underwater acoustic soundscapes. So with that basic idea in mind, I'll just give a brief bit of background about where this effort started. In 2010, then Administrator of NOAA, Jane Lubchenco, made a commitment to improve the tools that the agency uses to assess the impacts of anthropogenic or man-made sound on cetaceans. This led to an effort called Set Sound, which you can go to the website that I believe you should be able to get access to and learn a little bit more about that. But in very brief, there were two working groups formed as part of this. One was called Set Map, which produced maps of cetacean distribution and density, and the other group was called SoundMap, which produced predicted maps of sound fields from human activities. And the idea being there that you could look at the cetacean maps to see where animals are, and then you can look at the sound maps to see what the predicted levels of sounds might be. Now, when this effort concluded, there was a symposium that was very well received. This was reported on then to NOAA leadership, and they really encouraged us to move forward with a more of a long-term plan, a visionary plan about where we could get NOAA or how we could improve NOAA's ability to manage the impacts from underwater noise over, say, the next decade. And this led to the current ocean noise strategy effort. We began with a call for volunteers from all the different offices, or from many of the different offices within NOAA. We had a meeting back in about 2013 with a large number of people across line offices, scientists, management folks, people involved in legal aspects, and so on, to have input into the development of this ocean noise strategy. Overall now, the Ocean Noise Strategy is a NOAA initiative that seeks to guide the agency towards more comprehensive and effective management of ocean noise impacts over the next decade. And the roadmap document, which we finalized today, it really more fully articulates the overarching Ocean Noise Strategy goals, summarizes the status of science to support these goals, and it identifies a set of recommended cross-agency actions towards accomplishing those goals. So I think with that, I will turn it back over to Jenny and open it up to questions.
Thank you, Jason. And that website that Jason mentioned, there is a link in the press release to that website. And if you didn't get the press release, you can email me, Jenny, J-E-N-N-I-E, .Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, at NOAA, N-O-A-A.gov. At this time, we're going to open for reporter questions. Jay, can you please explain the process for asking a question?
Thank you. Yes, if you'd like to ask a question, you will hit star 1. You'll then unmute your phone and record your name. And if you need to withdraw your question, it is star 2. And again, to ask a question, please press star 1. It'll take a few moments for the questions to come through. Please stand by.
Okay. So we'll give you guys just a little bit of time to press star 1 or think of your questions. I hope you will take the time to ask those questions while we have our team of experts here for you.
And at this time, Jenny, I'm showing no questions queued up.
I do see some reporters on here, so I'll give you guys just a couple of minutes. And while you're thinking of your questions, I might actually pick on our experts a little bit. Leela, is there anything you'd like to add to anything that Jason said?
Well, I thought he did a great job of covering where we've been and why we got to this point. And I work for a part of NOAA that's very engaged in managing special places in U.S. waters called National Marine Sanctuaries. And this has been a really important effort for National Marine Sanctuaries as places that are really key to improving what we know about the effects of underwater noise and highlighting new tools for measurement and partnership to get better information and also to set priorities with local constituencies about how we can improve the quality of habitat in particularly important places where, like National Marine Sanctuaries.
Thank you, Leela. And we do have Malati Kay in line, and your line online, and your line should be open for a question now.
Okay. Thanks. My question is there any measure of how much ocean noise has risen in any span of time? Is there a specific number that we can quote?
Yeah, so I'm just going to repeat the question because it was so quiet. She's looking for if there's a way to measure how ocean noise has increased over time.
Yeah, sure. So that's actually one of the big gaps that we've identified in the roadmap, that there's really surprisingly limited data on long-term trends in ocean noise. But one of the most well-known cases occurred off the West Coast, and it demonstrated that over roughly half a century, so from the late 60s or the mid 60s until the mid 90s to the early 2000s, there has been a roughly 2 to 3 dB increase in low frequency underwater noise per decade, and over that time, there's been about a 10 dB increase over that time. Now, that's one of the most well-documented instances. There's been some more recent work, which basically says that, you know, we're, in the last 5 or 10 years now, some of those may be leveling off, may be dropping while other locations are increasing. But again, that I think just really highlights the gap there, that we need more information on that. There's very recently, there was another study published in the Atlantic Ocean from a listening station to the south of Bermuda, which showed a much smaller increase over that same period of time. But they're expecting, with the opening of the new Panama Canal, they're expecting that that will very likely change in a very short period of time. But I'm just going to go back to the fact that what this really does is this identifies, it highlights a really important gap that we need to fill. And one of the things that we've proposed that we've actually gone ahead now and implemented is something called the Ocean Noise Reference Station Network, which is basically a listening network that NOAA, a number of different offices across NOAA have all worked in collaboration to put this in place. We're also working with the National Park Service. We now have 11, soon to be 12, listening stations throughout U.S. waters. And the intent there is to get these in the water and have them in there over many years now so that we can document and characterize the long-term trends in underwater ocean noise.
Great. Our next question comes from Daryl Sears at the Washington Post. Daryl, great to see you on here.
Oh, thanks. I kind of wanted to ask two questions, and one would try and get at the point of this, but is there any indication of what is the main source of this noise? Is it civilian? Is it military? If it is, how have these sources grown over the years?
I could begin that.
Sure.
It depends very much what frequencies you're talking about, frequencies being tones, like tones on the piano, and way down low at some of the frequencies that a lot of marine animals, particularly some of our protected whales and whales use, or large whales. Those frequencies have been heavily affected by growth in commercial shipping. And in the places where we have been able to make those measurements, like Jason was talking about, northern hemisphere off the Central California coastline, there's been a very strong relationship between the growth in large commercial merchant shipping fleet in the Pacific and the measurements of lower frequency noise, so 40 and 50 hertz, 30 hertz. So these are tones that are not even optimal for human hearing, but they're particularly important to the calling behavior of whales like fin whales and blue whales. And at other frequencies, there are more dominant influences by other types of sources. And what we tried very hard to do in our set sound work that Jason referred to was to try to help people visualize the relative contributions of noise over different time periods and different frequency bands to really get at that point that in many cases the cumulative contribution of noise in a particular area over a particular time period can look very different than in another, depending on the constellation of sources that are present and what particular window you look at. If you look at a place off of Hawaii when the Navy happens to be doing a multi-day sonar experiment with a lot of ships and a lot of sonar use, and you happen to look in the frequency bands where they are making sounds for that purpose, then you're going to see a really significant contribution from that Navy event. But if you look over a much longer time period, even at the same frequency spectrum, the average contribution from background sources, like commercial ships, like wind and waves, even natural sources, can dominate the spectra. So these time windows are really important. The frequency lens is really important. And then on top of that, where you're looking in the ocean can be really important. The reason we tend to highlight a shipping contribution when you're looking at very large spatial scales is because low frequencies are such excellent propagators. And so when you're looking at ocean basin scale images of ocean noise contribution, shipping really is a really big contributor to backgrounds.
Thank you.
Great. Daryl, did you say you had a couple of questions? Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I think that she answered the kind of so what question. When we gather this data years from now, what conceivably will we do with it? What will it help? And I think that she answered that question.
Okay, great. Well, star one to get in line to ask a question or to get back in line if you've already asked a question. Right now I'm showing no other questions in line, so I'm going to give Jolie a chance to say anything she'd like to add to what's been said so far.
Hi there. This is Jolie, and I'm the Chief of the Permits and Conservation Division, and so my role in NOAA is sort of working with two groups. One that is involved in authorizing activities that might have impacts on marine mammals pursuant to the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And so through that, you know, we ensure that before we, you know, allow folks to go forward and impact marine mammals, that they're not going to have more than a certain level of impacts on populations and stocks. And also we put in place protective measures and monitoring measures. And one of the things that is really exciting to me is that taking a step back from that, I think before we engaged in this, you know, NOAA has a lot of intersects with noise. We do the things that the program I work with does in terms of, you know, regulating impacts on marine species, but we also have, you know, science centers that do science on marine species, and we also have activities that we endeavor, you know, in ourselves that put sound into the water. So across these three places where we touch ocean noise, I don't think we had really gotten together to try and think about the one direction for the agency and how those work together. And I think what's very exciting is as having a responsibility for trying to make sure that we protect marine species, knowing that as an agency, we'll be going in the same direction and we'll have, you know, kind of in place this feedback loop that is necessary to ensure that we make the best decisions in how to protect marine mammals based on the best science. And having all of that kind of rolled together in a way where we talk to each other and we're really moving forward in the most effective manner is very exciting to me. And another thing that I really look forward to, and Leela touched on this a little bit, is I think historically, if you're familiar with the program that I work with and incidental take authorization and those sorts of things, we've gotten pretty skilled and we've gathered a lot of science on the effects of noise more directly in terms of how they cause behavioral disturbance or potentially how they cause auditory injury when an animal is exposed to, you know, a particular loud sound in a given moment. We focus on those sorts of effects a lot, especially really with marine mammals. And one of the things that is exciting here with the noise strategy, and if you look at our roadmap in Chapter 2, you can read more about this, is kind of an agency augmenting that, you know, strength with a new focus on what I think Jason mentioned earlier, acoustic habitat, which means that, you know, in addition to having the potential to injure or cause a behavioral disturbance directly, as these background noise levels get louder, it inhibits marine species' abilities to hear those critical sounds that Jason was talking about that allow them to communicate with their conspecifics, to find their food, to avoid predators, those sorts of things. And that is an effect that we have not historically been able to get our hands around as well. And now, through this effort, we've really specifically identified it as something that we need to pursue. And as Jason mentioned, being sort of a gap in needing to better track soundscapes through time and space, this is another place where we need to, we know generally conceptually how things work, and the fact that, you know, rising background noises is not good for marine species that need to use that acoustic habitat. But that's an area where we need to focus more, both in figuring out how we protect marine species better and exactly the right way to do that, and gathering more information. So that's exciting, an exciting thing to me about the strategy. And the other thing that I will mention is, you know, Leela talked some about habitat and fish and invertebrates. And again, and this is through the lens of the program I work with, and also I think where a lot of more public attention has been in the past is the effects on marine mammals. But, you know, marine mammals aren't the only acoustically sensitive species in the ocean, and a lot of fish and invertebrates use sound for a lot of different important purposes, and we're learning more about how again, effects on acoustic habitat can negatively affect them. And being able to wrap that into an agency strategy to holistically really look at all the resources that NOAA is tasked with protecting is very exciting. And so I think for me, it's, you know, we work a lot with our external stakeholders, and that's one of the main goals of the strategy moving forward. But it's also, to me, very exciting to have our agency be able to focus to, you know, build our knowledge of the correct terms and concepts and metrics that are best going to support our protective and science endeavors in this field. And that's what, one of the reasons that I'm really excited about the strategy, so I'll just say that.
All right. So I'm still showing no questions in line. If you want to press star one to ask a question, we'll give you just another – we'll hang on just another second before we close. Also, for the names and the titles of the folks you can quote here in the room, our experts, that those were listed in our media advisory. If you did not get that, feel free to email me, and I will make sure you get that, that it'll have the correct spelling and titles for them. And again, my email is Jenny, J-E-N-N-I-E, dot Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, at NOAA, N-O-A-A, dot gov. And Melati, go ahead. I see that you have another question.
Yeah. Thanks. NOAA has a lot of programs that operate in the U.S., but also outside, in Asia, in Africa. And I was just wondering, since marine mammals, particularly, are migratory species and they are affected by noise, and commercial shipping lanes are worldwide, is there plans on NOAA's side to set up some of these listening stations or some of the research work abroad also?
That's a really good question. I mean, our focus for the strategy roadmap has been on U.S. waters for the most part, but I think we are certainly keeping ourselves very much aware of any work that's taking place elsewhere. We have colleagues that have, I'll just throw out one example since I used to work down there. There's a similar type of system in Australia, a listening network system off the coast of Australia. And, you know, those are colleagues that we communicate with regularly. So we'll certainly be keeping abreast of the research that's taking place elsewhere. There are, as you mentioned, a number of NOAA offices that do conduct work in international waters, off of Antarctica, for example. Those will carry on. I don't think there's an immediate plan specifically as part of the ocean noise strategy to do that type of expansion just yet. But I do think that those types of things will come up as individual offices look to how they're going to implement the ocean noise strategy. And that is very likely to be something that will be part of the implementation of this strategy, is individual offices are going to come back and say, okay, we're doing this type of work. We're going to continue looking at ocean noise in these islands in the Southern Ocean or something, for example.
Thanks.
Can I just add that instrumentation, I think it's great that we've highlighted the instrumentation as a really big backbone for understanding the problem and making sure we have the data to make good management decisions. But the strategy ultimately is, of course, about addressing the impacts. And Julie touched on a lot of the mechanisms that NOAA has that are cross-programmatic to actually do some of that work and to do it in a precautionary way. That is an approach, you know, those management drivers are increasingly looking like the goals that we have under the strategy in other countries. One example of that would be in the European Union, their Marine Strategy Framework Directive specifically calls out noise as a factor in the marine environment that has to reach good environmental status over a period of time, and it also particularly understands that noise can come in flavors that can have effects at close proximity that are injurious, and it can have these longer-term effects as part of a degradation chronically of the background environment. That is very much those themes are echoed quite a bit in the perspective of the NOAA Ocean Noise Strategy, which is an attempt to ensure that the U.S. is noise policies also recognize that we have to address these shorter-term implications for individual animals and populations, and we also have to address the fact that noise is an aspect of the environment that with other stressors can become degraded over you know, sometimes quite large spatial scales. So there's that instrumentation internationally. We have to collaborate with that, and we also work very closely with partners in other areas who are trying to move our noise management techniques towards the scales that are appropriate to the issue.
And I'll just chime back in here, Melody, because when you first asked the question, I immediately went to research. And, you know, I didn't think of some other examples here. And I'll just mention one that, you know, we talked about low-frequency noise traveling vast distances. So clearly noise that's produced in international waters can – that noise just ignores, you know, boundaries. So, you know, what are the – sorry, noise that's produced in international waters will travel into U.S. waters and vice versa. But one of the things that we have been working on is we've been working with the shipping industry on the possibility of producing or retrofitting ships to produce less noise. And, you know, over a number of years, there was a strong effort within the IMO, and some voluntary guidelines were put out that, you know, highlighted the issue and basically gave a number of recommendations for ways that noise output from ships could be reduced. And then, again, getting back to that bigger picture context, international waters and so on, if we can actually have quieter ships in international waters, we will likely reduce the amount of low-frequency background noise from human activities.
So I am not showing any questions in the queue right now. Give you all a chance, star one, if you have anything else you'd like to ask. Going once, going twice. Sold. All right. Well, again, you can email me for the press release or the names and titles.
Jenny, sorry to interrupt. Melody did queue up again.
Just queued up again. All right, Melody, go ahead.
Sorry about that. Very last question. What has been the uptake of the suggestions to modify to quieter ships or within the shipping industry?
Sorry, Melody, can you expand that a little bit? I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Yeah, just you were saying that NOAA has been working with the shipping industry, encouraging ships to use quieter equipment, and I'm just curious, how well has those suggestions been taken up?
Like, that's a very good question.
How many ships have changed?
Right. So NOAA's role in working on the shipping noise problem, because it's not a source type that we directly regulate in some of the other ways, we've been providing leaderships with additional federal action agencies in the U.S., the Coast Guard, the Maritime Administration, who work at the International Maritime Organization to try to move forward on various different environmental issues and ship design issues. So we provided the leadership in that correspondence group, and it led to the ratification of these voluntary guidelines. And the next steps were discussed in that body were for individual shipping companies and individual countries to come up with pilot studies that would better assess what the cost effectiveness is of implementing some of those design changes, and also how to take them into a more holistic, what I'll call green shipping design paradigm, because those are the big pressures on a lot of the shipping companies are to come into compliance with carbon emission standards. And that will lead to changes in shipping design that are big drivers for ships that are being designed today. And the questions were, because a lot of the noise produced by ships comes from propeller inefficiency, that is the creation of bubbles underwater that cavitate or burst and make a signature sound. And propeller inefficiency also uses more fuel than a ship would want. So there's always been this interest in seeing over what time horizon a more efficient propeller, which is also likely to be quieter, would make up for the cost that were put out to make it a quieter propeller. lot of that designing and testing has to be done in model basins, and it needs to be done in the context of all the other drivers that go into how you build tomorrow's ships. So we've been trying to look for those partners and find the drivers for those partners. And right now, some of the pressures for that, the interests for that, are coming from ports. There are a few ports in the Pacific Northwest in Canada that have been looking, that are being built or expanded in areas that have very strong environmental sensitivities, and in particular nearby cetacean populations. And they have been working to build both shipping noise measurement systems for ships coming in and out of their ports, and also incentivization programs for ships to find out what their noise profile is relative to the profiles of other ships of a similar class, and try to find out ways that the port can incentivize them the good environmental status, the ships with higher environmental status or lower noise. Those are systems that are being built in ports. They're not specifically trying to throw any port, any ship out of a particular port, so they're not as strong as, for example, Aviation Administration regulations on air on planes that are too loud. Planes that are too loud are not allowed to fly and coming in and out of airports. This is the baby steps towards ports having a role in trying to incentivize the implementation of those guidelines. And I think we're going to be watching some of those paradigms play out with a lot of different international drivers, and that will, over time, answer your question of which of these companies decide to really sign up for building quieter ships.
Thanks.
Jolie or Jason, anything to add?
No.
Okay. I'm seeing no more questions. So at this time, I just want to thank you all for joining our call. And if you have any other questions, feel free to contact me directly. Again, my name is Jenny Lyons. My phone number at my desk is 301-427-8013. Thank you for joining our call.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference, and thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.